get started. So I'm William Frischuk. I'm a member of the Heinrich Physics faculty here in the Physics Department, and it's a pleasure to introduce Ian Chipsey to give today's colloquium. Ian is a professor in the Physics Department at Purdue University, and he's a colleague of mine, although oddly, in high-energy physics, with the big collaborations, you think you've collaborated with everybody in your life, but in fact, I've never shared an author list with Ian, but I have worked with him on and off building silicon detectors for high-energy physics experiments. That's both of our hobbies and interests, and so we've been collaborating by email for a number of years. But today he's not come to talk to us at all about high-energy physics. Interestingly, I was thinking back, about half the people that I've brought into the colloquium didn't talk about high-energy physics. They talked about other things. We had a colloquium a couple years ago on recording sounds from the 1800s using physics, high-energy physics technology. And today he's going to tell us more about sound, about cochlear implants and their impact on curing deafness. And I just think it's a sort of typical, unexpected spin-off of high-energy physics that one gets into other avenues and solves other problems like this and can apply the things one learns in physics in other avenues altogether. So, Ian, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'll begin at the beginning. In October 1989, I had perfect hearing. But by the end of that year, I had no hearing whatsoever. It began when I could not hear the quiet passages of music on a car radio. That day, turning up the volume helped. But soon, there was no more music. At the same time, the voices of friends and of family receded, and I entered a world of silence. The reason for my deafness was a medically necessary dose of ototoxic antibiotics that destroyed the hair cells in my cochlea. The reason for the antibiotics was that earlier that year, I'd contracted acute myelogenous leukemia, a truly terrible form of cancer. But thanks to friends at Purdue, at Syracuse, and at Cornell universities, I received first-rate medical care at the Cornell University Medical College in New York City. An industrial-strength dose of chemotherapy beat the cancer, but it left me without an immune system. And the antibiotics protected me until my own immune system had returned. For many, suddenly losing your hearing, becoming deaf, is a truly terrible disability. You can read of countless cases of people who have suddenly lost all of their hearing. And without an appropriate support network, they withdraw from society, become depressed, and in some cases turn to substance abuse and even to suicide. For the majority of citizens who lose just part of their hearing, studies show they still leave the workforce years earlier than they otherwise would do, and generally lead less fulfilling and productive lives. Children born deaf often fare worse. In the United States, they're sent to schools with children who can hear, but they lack the ability to develop an oral linguistic tradition and leave school at the age of 18 with the reading age of a 12-year-old, a gap that is too large to close. Fortunately, science and technology are coming to the rescue to treat many forms of deafness, and in this talk, I'll talk about one of those treatments, the cochlear implant. So the outline of the talk. I'll begin by looking at the physiology of natural hearing and then the causes of deafness. 10% of the population cannot hear well. I'll look at solutions for hearing loss, in particular the cochlear implant. I'll briefly discuss some of the political and social issues that surround this still controversial technology. I'll then look at what cochlear implants tell us about the functioning of the human brain before briefly looking at the future of the technology. So I'd like to begin with a tour of the ear. The video that I will show you is called Auditory Transduction. It was written by Brandon Pletch, a young medical illustrationist from Georgia, and it was awarded first place in the National Science Foundation AAAS Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge, a large national competition in the United States, in 2003. It's been heavily edited for this talk by one of my undergraduate students, Stephen Lichty, and myself. So sound is a form of mechanical energy. When we strike a tuning fork, the oscillatory motion of the tines set nearby air molecules into oscillatory motion. And they in turn set more distant molecules into oscillatory motion. And in this way, sound moves through the air as a mechanical disturbance, a vibration of air molecules. Until it arrives at our pina, which collects the sound and funnels it down onto the ear canal, which is about a centimeter in diameter. And from there to the tympanic membrane, otherwise known as the eardrum. And the tympanic membrane vibrates in response to sound. I think that was loud enough. Now, the tympanic membrane is conical in shape, and it's articulated by three small bones collectively called the ossicles. They are the malleus or hammer, the incus or anvil, and the stapes or footplate, with the stapes being about the size of a grain of rice, so the three smallest bones in the human body. And it's through the ossicles that the vibrations of the tympanic membrane are transmitted to the stapes. Now, the stapes moves with a piston-like action at the oval window of the bony labyrinth. The labyrinth, about 3 centimeters across, is an entirely enclosed structure, and it's filled with a fluid, shown here in purple, that's similar to cerebral spinal fluid. It's sodium-rich. And if the labyrinth was entirely closed, the stapes would not be able to displace the fluid within the labyrinth, and so vibrations could not enter the structure. But thanks to the presence of a flexible membrane called the round window, the stapes can displace the fluid, and so sound energy can enter the bony labyrinth. In more detail, the bony labyrinth consists of 2 distinct parts, the semicircular canals, which are our organs of balance, and the snail-shaped cochlea, which is our organ of hearing. So vibrations are drawn into the helical structure, where they arise to the apex, and descend to the round window. In more detail, the cochlea consists of 2 principal ducts called scalae. The vibrations arise in the scala vestibuli, and they descend to the round window in the scala tympani. These 2 scalae are about 0.3 millimeters across, 3 millimeters across, and the cochlear duct is about 0.3 millimeters across, and that's the 3rd duct separated from the 1st 2. These are sodium-rich, this is potassium-rich, and it's this difference in chemical composition that gives rise to the power of the cochlea. Now, the cochlea is very small. It's about the size of a pea. And the reason it is so small is so that low levels of vibration can perturb it. In other words, so that we can hear very soft sounds. And it forms early. This is the cochlea at 6 months gestation in the human. At birth, the cochlea is fully formed and fully functional. If we increase the magnification, the cochlear duct is separated from the scalae by Reisner's membrane and the basilar membrane. And these 2 membranes are flexible. And so when vibrations pass through the fluids of the scalae, they cause the 2 membranes to flex. And on the 2nd of these membranes, on the basilar membrane, there's a specialized organ called the organ of Corti. And when this organ, which is shown here in green, is stimulated, it produces electricity that passes to the brain along the auditory nerve that fills the hollow modiolus of the cochlea and innervates it upon its entire 35 millimeter helical length. The origin of the electrical signals are specialized cells called hair cells, inner hair cells, and three rows of outer hair cells. The hair cells are closely covered by a gelatinous membrane called the tectorial membrane. And when the basilar membrane moves back and forth, the hair cell cilia are flexed, causing the cells to trigger and fire, producing the electricity that we perceive as sound. And so the hair cells are mechano-electrical transducers. Now, the basilar membrane does not respond and vibrate simultaneously to sound. Instead, it responds variably. The apex of the basilar membrane resonates at low frequencies, and the base of the basilar membrane resonates at high frequencies. And so the basilar membrane is a frequency analyzer, and we refer to this organization as tonotopic organization. And this is a tonotopic map of the cochlea, showing the frequencies at which the basilar membrane resonates. Where the basilar membrane is small and stiff, the resonant frequency is about 20 kilohertz. At the apex, where the basilar membrane is larger and less stiff, the resonant frequency is much lower, around several hundred hertz. And so, from the motion of air molecules to the vibration of a tympanic membrane, to the transmission of those vibrations through the ossicles to the stapes, to the displacement of the stapes, which pushes fluid in the scale, to the vibration of the basilar membrane, to the flexing of the hair cells, to the production of electricity that passes on the brain via the auditory nerve. It is the sequence of events that gives rise to our auditory perception of the world around us. Now, it won't surprise you to know that it was physicists that developed this theory of how we hear. Helmholtz was the first to recognize that the basilar membrane was a frequency analyzer. And the biophysicist George von Beckege won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1961 for experimental measurements of basilar membrane displacements on human cadavers. This is some of his data taken in the 1930s. This is the base, this is the apex of the basilar membrane, and this is displacement. As the frequency input to the basilar membrane is increased, the point of maximum displacement moves towards the base. Clear evidence for tonotopic organization. Two things I ask you to remember about this slide. First, that these results were obtained in human cadavers. And secondly, that very loud sounds were used to render displacements visible, 140 decibels and above, because displacement is proportional to loudness of the sound. And von Beckege had at his available only two things, a microscope and a stroboscope. So the displacements had to be of order the wavelength of light or larger. Now, von Beckege's findings in human cadavers stimulated the production of a very large number of mechanical models that could reproduce the observed wave shapes that he had seen. And I show an example here. This is position along the basilar membrane, which is 36 millimeters long. We're showing the first 16 millimeters only, so this is the base. And this is displacement. So this is the prediction of a mechanical model when the sound input is at a low level, 10 or 20 decibels, close to the threshold of human hearing, when the displacement of the basilar membrane is of order nanometers. This is a log scale. And what you can see from this is a very broad wave that occupies about a quarter of the entire basilar membrane. These same models predict that when the frequency of this pure 10 kilohertz tone is changed for a 20 kilohertz tone, which is a very different frequency, that the wave shape hardly alters. And so these models predict that the human cochlea is poorly tuned, that we have poor frequency selectivity, in other words, poor pitch perception. But this is in stark contrast to the psychophysics of human hearing. C is 256 hertz. C sharp is 5% higher. A human can tell 1/10 the difference between C and C sharp at 256 hertz. 1 or 2 hertz. In 1945, the maverick astrophysicist Tommy Gold was thinking about hearing. And he was considering the following problem, that it's rather remarkable that we can hear soft sounds at all, because the scalae are full of fluid. And so when the basilar membrane resonates, the fluids would damp down the resonance, producing no change. That is, unless there's some form of internal amplifier in the basilar membrane that would drive basilar membrane displacement. Now, at the time, his ideas were ignored. You could say they fell on deaf ears. And the reasons for this, I think, were twofold. The first reason was that Tommy Gold was an astrophysicist, not a physiologist. And the second is because I believe his ideas were not completely understood. While most people would understand that if there was an internal mechanism driving basilar membrane displacement, that would correspond to us hearing softer sounds. Why does this help the question of how we perceive pitch so well? Well, the way to think about that is to consider an example from our everyday experience, a child on a swing, which is a mechanical frequency selective system. In the first case, consider the child sitting passively on a swing and the mother pushing the child. The swing has a natural frequency, which is given by the length of the ropes. The mother can do very little work to push the swing at its natural frequency. She can work harder and push the swing at frequencies other than its natural frequency. And so this system supports a variety of frequencies, and so we would refer to it as not particularly well-tuned. But now remove the mother from the picture and remember your own experience as a child on a swing, all alone in the playground. When you kick your legs in time with the swing's amplitude rises dramatically. When you kick your legs out of time with the swing abruptly comes to a halt. The system has now become finely tuned because the source of the amplification is internal to the system. This was the idea that was not understood in 1945. Now, in the 1980s, it became possible for the first time to measure basilar membrane displacements in living creatures. And these are the results that were seen. So remember, this is the prediction of the von Beckerge model, and this is the data. Very different. For the same 10 kHz tone at the same low sound level, there's a much greater displacement. A 50 decibel amplification, a huge factor. And a very tiny piece of the basilar membrane is actually excited. Just what we need for good pitch perception. And so this is the evidence that there is an amplifier within the organ of Corti that increases both this displacement and creates this very fine tuning. An internal amplifier. Another way to see this amplification is as follows. This is basilar membrane displacement in nanometers, and this is sound from soft sound to loud sound. The point up here is von Beckerge's data from the 1930s. The dashed line is the extrapolation down to much softer sounds, which correspond to much smaller basilar membrane displacements. And on the left are sensitive modern measurements on living animal cochlea. The much greater basilar membrane displacement is evidence over the whole sound range for amplification. And so, was von Beckerge wrong? Should he have not got the Nobel Prize? These measurements are performed on guinea pigs, literally guinea pigs. The guinea pig has a cochlea that's particularly well suited to studying it. However, it's a very delicate measurement. You have to open the skull of the guinea pig. You have to open the cochlea. And you then have to look at the tiny motions of this basilar membrane. This is a most unpleasant experience for the guinea pig. And sometimes, when this data is being taken, the guinea pig dies. And if you continue to take the data after the guinea pig is dead, The same animal post-mortem. The data falls onto the line predicted by von Beckerger. When you're dead, there's no amplification and there's no fine-tuning. And so von Beckerger was not wrong. He got the results he did because he performed them on human cadavers. He was, in fact, a great pioneer of biophysics. So what causes this amplification? This is a high magnification image of the basilar membrane of the human. Inner hair cells and three rows of outer hair cells. Each cochlea has 10,000 inner hair cells and they're afferent with signals going to the brain. The outer hair cells, in contrast, are sparsely innervated. This is a typical inner hair cell, about 30 microns long and 5 microns wide. In more detail, each hair cilia is 500 nanometers wide and they're joined by tip lengths, actin fibers, which are less than 10 nanometers in diameter. When the basilar membrane moves back and forth and pushes the cilia against the tectorial membrane, the cilia deflect and the tip lengths pull open pores in the walls of the cilia, allowing the potassium-rich solution to flood into the hair cells. Hair cells are like batteries, cells are like batteries, they're all highly polarized. And so the arrival of this current rapidly depolarizes the cell. And then through a sequence of complex chemical steps, neurotransmitters are released at the base of the cell, causing action potentials on the auditory nerve, and we hear sound. And both inner and outer hair cells work in this way. So if the inner hair cells are sending signals to the brain that we hear a sound, what do the outer hair cells do? Well, the outer hair cells, in fact, also exhibit electromotility. They are electromechanical transducers, and they are, in fact, the amplifier of our hearing. So this is an outer hair cell. It's about 70 microns long. And we're going to play some music to the outer hair cell. The output from the loudspeaker will pass on an electrode into the outer hair cell. And the current that passes will be modulated by the tempo and amplitude of the music. And when the music starts, watch what happens to the length of the cell.
10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 55,
Sorry, that was a little loud. So, first thing you should remember about this movie is the next time that you dance to the music, it's not just you that's dancing. It's 30,000 other house elves at each of your healthy cockpit. So the house elf was contracting by several microns in response to the current that it was seeing. And so the sequence of events is that sound enters the cochlea, fluids cause the basilar membrane to resonate at specific frequencies at specific places. The basilar membrane then is displaced, causing a deflection of the outer hair cell cilia. They open links, pores in the cilia of the cells, and the potassium current from the solution here in the cochlear duct floods into those cells, causing the same kind of contraction you saw in the movie. These cells are like springs. They're attached to the basilar membrane, and as they shorten, they pull the basilar membrane up, displacing it more than it otherwise would have been. In this way, even the smallest of sounds can lead to significant basilar membrane displacement, and hence the deflection of inner hair cell cilia. Current then passes into the inner hair cells, neurotransmitters are released at the base of the cell, and we hear sound. There's five main causes of deafness. The first is genetic. The second is infections, typically bacterial meningitis or rubella. The third is acute or chronic exposure to extremely loud sounds, which simply cause hair cells to be taken beyond their elastic limit and they actually physically break. The fourth cause is prescription drugs, such as the ototoxic antibiotics that I had in 1989, but very common antibiotics, myosins, or certain chemotherapeutic agents as well. And the fifth cause of deafness is old age. which affects almost everybody, 10% of the population cannot hear well. The main types of hearing loss are first conductive. That would be when the ossicles are physically broken. A mechanical break can be actually repaired through surgery, and hearing can be restored. However, 70% of all hearing loss is sensory neural, which means loss of hair cells. And in the vast majority of those cases, a person has experienced a partial loss, and that leads to a mild or a moderate loss of hearing, which can be very effectively corrected with very simple or very advanced hearing aids. However, in 4% of all hearing loss, about 0.4% of the entire population, a large loss of hearing cells has occurred. And so hearing aids are not going to help, because no matter how loud the sounds, hearing aids are simply amplifiers. So no matter how loud those sounds are, no matter how vigorously the stapes moves those fluids backwards and forwards in your cochlea, there's no transducers to turn that sound into electricity and pass it to the brain. And it's for these people that the cochlear implant can sometimes offer a solution. That may surprise you to know that the first cochlear implant was invented in 1800 by the very distinguished scientist Volta. Volta placed two metallic probes in both ears and connected the ends of the two probes to a 50-volt battery. And observed that, and this is a direct quote, "At the moment when the circuit was completed, I received a shock in the head, and some moments after I began to hear a sound, or rather a noise in the ears which I cannot well define. It was a kind of a crackling with shocks, as if some paste or tenacious matter had been boiling." They wrote beautifully in those days, don't you think? He went on to say, "The disagreeable sensation, which I believe might be dangerous because of the shock in the brain, prevented me from repeating the experiment." And if you doubt the veracity of this account, this is the reference. So now let's move forward 200 years to the modern cochlear implant. So unlike a hearing aid, which makes sounds louder, just amplifies them, a cochlear implant is going to bypass the non-functional hair cells, sending weak electrical signals directly to the brain. So I talk you through a modern cochlear implant. It starts with the sound being detected by a microphone, just as in a hearing aid. And then that's turned into an electrical signal. This is the microphone. I'm wearing a cochlear implant. Although this room is very large, you might be able to see it above my left ear. If some of you are in the front row or two, see the cochlear implant. So in this part of the cochlear implant, there's a speech processor, an application-specific integrated circuit. That's essentially a chunk of silicon. It's like a computer, but there's no operating system. There is memory, but no operating system. And the purpose of that is to analyze the spectrum of sound, the frequencies and the loudness, and then to digitize that information. And then that digital information is sent as pulses onto a coil antenna that's worn on the outside of the head. And that antenna will transmit those pulses using radio waves through the skull to the implant. My coil antenna is on the back of my right ear. Under the skin, at this point, there's a second application-specific integrated circuit, which is the inverse of the one worn exteriorly. It takes the digital information and reconstructs the sound as a series of volumes and a series of frequencies. And it codes those as a series of electrical currents, and which it then passes along electrodes into the cochlea. Current is then released at those electrodes and is picked up by the auditory nerve, which sends them to the brain, and the brain recognizes the signal as sound. And I should say that in this picture, the brain is not to scale. So the key idea is to use multiple electrodes at separate locations in the cochlea that will exploit the tonotopic organization both of the cochlea and hence of the auditory nerve as well. So this is the schematic from the last slide. the microphone, speech processor, a transmitter, then the skin, inside the patient, the receiver, there's a pulse generator as well, and then an electrode array in the cochlea. For every electrode in the cochlea, there is, in the speech processor, a corresponding bandpass filter that will emit only certain frequencies. The electrode at the cochlear base that corresponds physiologically to our perception of high-frequency sound corresponds here to a high-frequency bandpass filter. Electrodes at the cochlear apex that correspond physiologically to our perception of low-frequency sound have, in the exterior processor, low-frequency bandpass filters. And so, to give an example, the letter S, a high-frequency sound, is played to the microphone. The letter S passes through the microphone, and then, because it's high-frequency, passes only through the high-frequency bandpass filter. It's blocked by the others. It's then envelope detected, which means measure the amplitude as a function of time, loudness as a function of time. That's shown here. This is then digitized, transmitted, received, decoded, and a pulse appears on an electrode at the cochlear base. Subsequently, the lower frequency sound A is presented to the microphone. This sound can only pass through the lower bandpass filters. It's blocked by the high frequency bandpass filter. It's then encoded, digitized, and signals appear at the cochlear apex corresponding to our normal physiological response to low frequency sound. And this is a modern cochlear implant, multi-channel electrode, in the scalar tympani of the human cochlea, within light green, the auditory nerve. Each of these rectangles represents a pair of electrodes that may receive current. And when it flashes white, that represents a pulse of current being presented to the auditory nerve at that point. In my device, 18,800 pulses per second are presented to my auditory nerve. Now, cochlear implants have improved dramatically since the early 1980s. This is sentence recognition in implantees versus type of device. In 1980, the 3M Corporation developed a cochlear implant that had a single electrode. This enabled speech to be perceived, but not to be comprehended, because it did not exploit the tonotopic organization of the auditory nerve. But by the mid-1990s, with the best speech coding strategies, it was possible, with multi-channel electrodes that exploited tonotopic organization, to achieve 80% sentence recognition in the best cases. Now, I was aware of the great improvements that had occurred in cochlear implants, but I didn't myself have a cochlear implant. And the reason I hadn't was because I had heard that the outcome varies very widely. And then in 2001, I was at a conference at Caltech, and I was talking to a very good friend of mine, the distinguished lattice gauge theorist, Andreas Quantfeld from Fermilab. And he told me that his brother-in-law had a cochlear implant. So I talked to his brother-in-law, and the brother-in-law told me that the cochlear implant had changed his life. And so I decided to learn more about the device. So first, who can actually have a cochlear implant? I'll describe the situation in the United States because that's the one I know. First, I'll talk about adults. By adult here, I mean 18 years of age or older, but you can be 90 years of age and benefit from a cochlear implant. The requirements in the US are that you be bilaterally, severely to profoundly sensory neurodeaf, with little benefit from state-of-the-art hearing aids in a six-month trial. Approximately 1 million U.S. citizens qualify, 37,000 of them had a cochlear implant as of the end of 2005, which is the last year for which full data is available. 22,000 of these were adults, 15,000 were children. You need to be psychologically suitable. And the time I was being interviewed, I was deaf and I was lip reading. And they said to me, no psychotics. And I thought they said, no physicists. And you should have no anatomic or medical contraindication. And if you pass all these requirements, then there's an extensive audiological and medical testing, CAT scan, MRI, and so on. And then you have to choose the device that you would like implanted. And there are three main choices of state-of-the-art multi-channel cochlear implants. Cochlear in Australia, Med-El in Austria, and Claren in the US are the three main manufacturers. All devices have similar performance. The patient is by far the largest variable in the outcome. And then you have to wait for surgery. That can take many, many months in the United States. And finally, the surgery day arrives. This is a surgery. An opening is made at the round window of the bony labyrinth called the cochleostomy. The electrode is inserted into the scarlet tympani, and a postage stamp-sized recess is carved into human mastoid bone to receive the receiver stimulator, a magnet, and an antenna. It's a major surgery, 2 to 4 hours under general anesthesia. The complication rate is fortunately very low. The most likely thing is wound infection or skin breakdown. That can usually be resolved very efficiently. There's a possibility of facial nerve injury because the cochleostomy occurs just 1 millimeter from the facial nerve. If the facial nerve is transected, it leads to permanent facial paralysis, which is a tragedy for the patient, but also for the surgeon. There's a possibility of vertigo because the bony labyrinth also houses our organ of balance. That usually resolves as well. Then there is hardware failure. When that happens, you simply take the device out and replace it. And now, from now on, you have to avoid MRI because you have a magnet in your head. The purpose of the magnet is to hold the transmitter exterior to the skull in close proximity to the receiver on the inside of the skull so that the signals will be efficiently transferred. And then you have to wait 8 weeks for the wound to heal before the device can be activated and you will learn whether you can hear or not. And at least in the US, during those 8 weeks, you wonder how to pay the medical bill. So the cost in the US is the following. A cochlear implant costs about $60,000 US, including evaluation, surgery, postoperative hospital care, extensive audiological rehabilitation. In the US, the Medicare and Medicaid, the state system, pays total or partial costs depending on the state in which you live. Some private insurers refuse to cover the device, while others are happy to pay for it. Here's a quote. The reimbursement levels have forced 8 hospitals to close cochlear implant programs due to the cost of subsidizing the implants in the United States. Other hospitals ration services by putting children on waiting lists. There's currently 45,000 US children eligible. Only 15,000 have a cochlear implant. And yet the cost of a cochlear implant, $60,000, is very, very small compared to the enormous cost in government aid and training estimated by the US government themselves as more than $1 million throughout the course of a lifetime. And that does not mention the great challenge and human cost of going through life-death in a world where most people can hear. Another quote. Ultimately, this is about the way society views hearing. Being deaf is not going to kill you, and so the insurance companies do not view this as necessary. So I was one of the lucky ones. My cochlear implant was fully covered by insurance, and today I'm on a university committee that sets benefits for all people at Purdue University, a university of 37,000 students, 120 miles south of Chicago. And we've changed Purdue policy so that now everybody at Purdue is fully covered for a cochlear implant. That was not the case in 2002. When I was implanted, however, a special exception had to be made. So after 8 weeks of waiting, the activation day arrives. In my case, I was implanted in November, and we'd been planning to go to Europe to see family for the holidays. And so we were extremely disappointed to learn that the activation would occur in January. But then we asked, would there be cancellations? And they said, there's no chance of a cancellation. 4 days before we were to get on the plane, my wife had a telephone call. And from the hospital, and they said, there's been a cancellation, please send Ian down the next day. So I drove to Indianapolis, the Riley Hospital for Children, which is where my implant occurred. And you walk into an audiologist's office, and you're attached to a PC. And various settings are downloaded into memory, and continuity is checked. And I say a PC advisedly, because I crash a Mac, I'm not Mac compatible. And all of these tests take what seems like an age, several hours. And during this time, you hear absolutely nothing. And then the audiologist turned to me, and I was still lip reading. And she said, "We are going to turn the device on now and in several more minutes. Please understand that you may hear absolutely nothing when we turn the device on. If you're lucky, you will hear soft sounds. Not enough information to recognize speech, but you'll at least you'll hear, and with time you'll understand more. And if you're extremely lucky, you'll be able to understand speech right away." So she went back to her PC and continued to work. And after several more minutes, I said to her, "Have you turned on this device yet?" And before the end of that sentence, I'd heard my own voice for the first time in 12 years. But better yet, that evening I got home and I heard my wife's voice for the first time in 12 years. And because my daughter was born after I had become deaf, I heard my daughter's voice for the first time ever. And there really are no words in the English language to describe just how wonderful all of this was. So how well does my device work? This is an audiogram that you may have seen if you've ever had your hearing tracked. This is soft sound, loud sound versus frequency. This is the hearing threshold of a normal hearing, about 10 decibels. This is my hearing before the operation. My hearing threshold was around 100 decibels, which meant that if I stood on the runway and a jumbo jet was taking off, I would hear it. This is 6 months after the activation. So there's a dramatic improvement in my hearing. My hearing has continued to improve since that time. And I would now be classified as mildly hard of hearing. These are speech tests performed before the implant, in which I scored 0%. It's kind of embarrassing to be a physics professor and get 0% on a test. And these are the same tests 6 months afterwards, where in the easiest test I was scoring 96%. At the time these tests were performed, my results were exceptional. The good news is that today that's no longer true. 75% of recent post-lingually deaf adults implanted with a state-of-the-art device can use a telephone. So why does this device work? There's 10,000 exquisite hair cells in your healthy cochlea, and I only have 10 electrodes. And yet I can hear almost as well as you can hear. The reason that it works is because perception, whether it is visual or whether it is auditory, is a combination of top-down and bottom-up processing. The need for sensory detail depends strongly on the distinctiveness of the object and the level of familiarity that you have with that object. For example, if you're in the jungle and you see a huge grey animal in the distance coming towards you, you don't need much detail to know that it's an elephant. So I'd like to give you a visual example of this, something that is reasonably familiar. To American audiences, it's extremely familiar. It will be slightly less familiar to you. And I'd ask you to tell me who this person is. Who is that? Right, that's right, Lincoln. Now, there's not really enough sensory detail there to know it's Lincoln, but I told you it was a person. You guess it would probably be a famous person. I even hinted US people are likely to recognize it. There was a lot of top-down information that you could use to recognize that this was Lincoln. For those that can't see Lincoln, let me add a little more information. So he used top-down processing. The language equivalent of that would be a famous phrase, for example, with a word missing. For example, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United of America." Everybody knows the missing word is states. The word was never said. You know it by filling in the blanks, by context, top-down processing. That's exactly what a post-lingually deaf person does when they use a cochlear implant. I don't hear every word. I use top-down processing to fill in the blanks. Now let me show you another image which is familiar to you. But it's not as familiar as Lincoln's face. You've all seen it before. But this time, I'm removing your ability to use top-down processing. You're going to have to rely on bottom-up processing. So what is this? Anybody know? Nobody knows, right? Let me double the amount of information. Let me double it again. Anybody know what this is? Nobody knows what this is ever, because there's not enough information. Let me add a little more. Now you'll start to get it now, I think. Look, here it comes. It's a famous painting by Dali in the time sequence. Almost all of you have seen an image like this at some point in your lives. But it's not distinctive enough to use top-down processing. You had to use bottom-up processing. The language equivalent of that is missing words in an unfamiliar phrase, or words out of context, or language heard for the first time through a cochlear implant. That's exactly the situation a child born deaf is in when they're presented with information through a cochlear implant. They have to work bottom up. It's a much, much harder challenge than it is for a late deaf and adult. So this is a photograph of the word choice. This is frequency against time. And it's been color-coded. White means loud. So this is the first syllable, ch, the second syllable, oi, and the third syllable, s. And this is the same word through a cochlear implant, where we've replaced frequency with electrode. Clearly, these two patterns are similar. But are they similar enough to recognize that that word is choice? How do we optimize cochlear implants to maximize speech recognition? We need to know what features of the pattern of neural output from the cochlea are the most critical. Is it important to represent amplitude faithfully? Whether I speak loudly, whether I shout, or whether I speak softly, you can still understand what I'm saying. So you can guess that amplitude is not that important, and indeed it is not. What about the temporal structure of speech? That correlates with the pulse rate of the cochlear implant. It turns out that as long as you pulse the auditory nerve sufficiently fast that you cannot feel the words, in the same way that when you look at a movie, if it moves too slowly, you'd see the frames changing. But as long as you go above 50 hertz for the eye is happy with the continuous motion. It turns out to be about 1,000 hertz for a cochlear implant. And so this is not important either. It turns out the most important thing is the number of locations at which the auditory nerve is stimulated and the place at which you stimulate. And so I'd like to play for you a sentence in English. And the first time that I play it, it will go through one bandpass filter with all in-channel variation removed. And I'd ask you to tell me what this sentence is. Did anybody know what that was? Right. Okay, let's go to two channels. One for the low frequencies, one for the high frequencies. I'm going to turn down the volume a little bit here. So, okay, you could hear a difference, right, between two channels and one channel. But it wasn't recognizable as speech. Let me go to four channels. Anybody know? Okay, but it's getting closer. Before I play eight channels, let me tell you I have 10 channels, 10 electrodes. 10 and 8 are about the same number. And I can understand speech for 10 channels. So I can understand the 8 channels. I think some of you will understand it. If you know, call it out. Anybody know? Yeah, some people are getting it. I like to play tennis, right? Now, some people got it because they're good at bottom-up processing. Others didn't because they're not so good at bottom-up processing. So now let me play you the original. Before I play the original, let me tell you that to me, the 8 channel and the original sound identical. To you, they will sound very different.
I like to play tennis.
So now, for those of you that didn't have enough bottom-up skill to recognize 8 channels originally, now you've got the top-down knowledge, let me replay 8 channels to you, and all of you will understand the 8 channels.
I like to play tennis.
You see? So now you understand how a cochlear implant works. So this is sentence recognition in implantees. As you turn on the number of channels in their implant, when you get to 6 to 8, they understand most speech. And it's the most important factor for speech recognition, the number of spectral channels of information, which is strongly correlated but not identical to the number of electrodes. One final thing to say about how we understand speech for cochlear implants. This is the cochlear, and this is the cochlear uncurled. The cochlear is 35 millimeters long, but the electrode array inserted into the cochlear is only between 15 and 25 millimeters long, depending on the model. And this means that only part of the auditory nerve is stimulated, typically between 500 hertz and 5,000 hertz in the normal tonotopic scale. But because most speech spans this range, there's some fricative sounds up to 9 kilohertz or more. This means that you'll have to compress the frequencies to get them into the place where the electrode is. So you'll be compressing the sound image, or else you'll have to throw some of the sound image away, one or the other. In addition, if you compress, some of the frequencies of speech will certainly not be going to the correct tonotopic place for a normal physiological response in the cochlea. And so there'll be a tonotopic shifting. This is rather like looking at an object but mixing up the colors, making the colors wrong. Let me give you a visual example of the frequency compression. If we look at this image of Lincoln that we now all recognize, right? Imagine trying to recognize that if it was first compressed that way or that way. It would be much, much harder. And this is why it takes time to learn how to adjust to the spectroscopically poor, compressed, tonotopically shifted, and even distorted image. That is to learn how to understand speech with a cochlear implant. So this is sentence recognition in 97 adults with a cochlear implant. And with time, they learn how to use their device. It's a beautiful demonstration of the plasticity of the adult brain. Plateau is about 80%. Now, all of the adults in this study were postlingually deaf. They had the advantage, therefore, of being able to use their top-down processing to understand speech. But what about children who don't have that advantage? Let me say a few words about the situation in the United States with the deaf community and cochlear implants. I don't know about the situation in Canada. Perhaps someone at the end can talk about that. So, as you know, and this is certainly true in Canada too, people can lead very, very full and very, very satisfying lives when they're members of the deaf community. Learning English is important, but learning speech is much less so in their community. So in the 1990s, there was strong opposition in the United States to pediatric implantation, while there was a general neutrality to the implantation of adults. The argument was that an implant would delay a deaf child's acquisition of sign language, which is their natural language, and their assimilation into the deaf community. In 1991, the American National Association of the Deaf stated that they deplore the FDA decision to approve pediatric implantation as being unsound scientifically, procedurally, and ethically. However, today the deaf community in the US tend to regard cochlear implantation as a personal decision. In 2000, the National Association of the Deaf said that we emphasize taking advantage of technological advancements that have the potential to improve the quality of life for deaf and hard of hearing persons and strongly supports the development of the whole child and of language and of literacy. So this is one of the most widely cited studies of language development in young children who are prelingually deaf and are implanted. This is language age versus natural age. For hearing children, at age 48 months, their language age is also 48 months. The open and closed circles are deaf children whose natural age is much greater than their English language age. The closed circles are children who will be implanted. The open circles will not be implanted and form a control group. And this is the extrapolated performance of the control group. Subsequently, some children were implanted, and you can see that their language age is greater than is predicted to have been their performance if they had not been implanted. And this is a truly remarkable result. To quote the paper, despite a large amount of individual variability, the best performers in the implanted group seem to be developing an oral linguistic system based largely on auditory input from a cochlear implant. A truly remarkable result, but it must be stressed. These children are placed in an exceedingly supportive environment in which they continue to sign, in which all manner of other visual cues are presented to them to help them assimilate language. Now, if I have 5 more minutes, I can say a little bit about how cochlear implants teach us about the functioning of our own brain. A physical stimulus passes through the cochleas and neurally encoded on the auditory nerve, and we hear the word cat. If you compare a normal hearer who must use his cochlear to a cochlear implant user who cannot use his cochlear but only stimulates his auditory nerve, you're directly testing the role of the cochlear in normal hearing. And we can look at pitch and what pitch means. In the tonotopic theory, we know pitch because of the place at which we're stimulated. According to that theory, if you stimulate the base electrodes of a cochlear implant, the implantee should experience a high pitch. And indeed he does. If you stimulate at the apex, he should perceive a low pitch, and indeed he does. However, the cochlear implant user does not have a fine-tuned cochlear because he has no hair cells. And so his ability to recognize pitch is very, very poor, and there's a lot of variability. Now, there's a second theory of how we know pitch, and that is from the rate at which neurons fire. What we don't know is at what point the human body turns from using the rate of firing to the tonotopic code. And we can explore that with cochlear implants. We can vary the pulse rate of the cochlear implant and ask the implantee, do they perceive a change in pitch? And it doesn't matter which electrode you use. As you increase the rate, they experience a pitch increase until 300 hertz, after which no pitch increase is evident. And so this is evidence for the temporal coding working in the natural physiology up to 300 hertz. But interestingly, no matter how finely you vary the pulse rate here, the implantee experiences pitch depths of 20 hertz. Normal hearing at these frequencies, it can measure steps of 1 to 2 hertz. And so this tells us that in normal hearing, we're using the tonotopic code to obtain the frequency resolution, even at those low frequencies, something that was not known before. Now, because of the poor pitch resolution, melody recognition is extremely difficult, although lyrics help. So I'd like to play for you a famous piece of music as it sounds to me through a cochlear implant. Wasn't that nice? Now, let me play it to you as it would sound originally. Before I do so, let me remind you that, to me, these two sound exactly the same. So there's still work to do in improving cochlear implants. So let me say two words about this. The first is that there are simple ways to improve cochlear implants. You can combine them with hearing aids. Many people, as they age, lose their ability to detect high-frequency sound, but they retain good low-frequency sound, especially with a hearing aid. And so you can use a short electrode that just stimulates the auditory nerve that corresponds to the high-frequency sounds. And when the hearing aid is used alone, these patients do not understand speech. With a cochlear implant, they do better, but with both devices, there's a dramatic improvement. The second improvement is to have two cochlear implants rather than one. How do we know where sound comes from? When the sound source is closer to our left ear than our right ear, it arrives at our left ear before our right ear. It then passes on variable length delay lines from both cochlea to common neurons in the medial superior olive. When the signals arrive in coincidence, the neuron fires. If the sound source is now moved slightly to the right, the time delay between arriving at the left and right ear changes. And so the point of coincidence occurs at a different common neuron, and that neuron fires. And in this way, humans have developed the ability to tell the direction of sound to 1 degree in the plane of our ears. However, if you have a single cochlear implant, there's only signals arriving into one side of these common neurons, and so they never fire. And so you do not know the direction of a sound. These were 7 people that had 2 cochlear implants. One was turned off. And they were asked, is the sound on your left or on your right? They got it right 50% of the time. But when both devices were turned on, they scored close to 100%, similar to a normal hearing person. But there's another reason why we want 2 implants rather than 1. And that's because you get better speech recognition in noisy environments, which are all too common in our modern world. If speech is from the front, noise is from the left, and the implant is on the left, it's hard to understand what somebody is saying. If the speech is from the front, the noise is from the right, and the implant is on the left, one performs much better. If the speech is from the front and the noise is from the left and you have 2 implants, it's possible to recognize 100% of the speech in a noisy environment. Hearing people would get 100% in all 3 of these tests, however. And in addition, if a patient has 1 cochlear implant and does not perform well with it, adding the second can make an enormous difference in the success of the implantation and device. And so the future of these devices, I've talked about these 2. There's other things going on as well, increasing the number of channels in the cochlear implant, increasing the length of the cochlear implant electrode, both of which are geared towards providing fine spectral information. This will lead to improved speech performance and improved music appreciation. There's also work ongoing on reducing power to make the device fully implantable instead of only partially implantable. And because cochlear implant performance is limited by the number of surviving auditory nerve neurons, there's work ongoing on the regeneration of neurons. And so to summarize, implants are enabled the postlingual deaf to hear, and they have provided sufficient information to support language development in children, which is a truly remarkable development. They've taught us a great deal about speech recognition, which is useful well beyond cochlear implants. They've taught us that spectral and tonotopic cues are the most important. The number of electrodes, the frequency assignment of the electrodes. And there's a nice demonstration of adult plasticity of the adult brain because of the cochlear implant learning curve. For music, speech quality, the recognition of male and female voices or accents, that's the kind of spectral information is well beyond what the current generation of cochlear implants provide. And implants have also taught us how the brain hears. For example, we now have a much deeper appreciation of how humans with normal hearing understand pitch. And finally, implants as the first prosthesis to successfully restore a neural function have become a benchmark in biomedical engineering. And so it seems to me that cochlear implants are a truly wonderful example of interdisciplinary science. All of the disciplines listed up here were necessary to make a tiny package work inside a human being to improve the human condition. There are about 100,000 implantees worldwide, and with the latest devices, 3/4 of postlingually deaf adults can use the telephone, and small children can not only hear their parents' voices, they're actually learning to understand them. At a personal level, 3 years ago, I had my hearing restored. It's enabled me to more easily conduct research and to teach and to hear my wife's voice for the first time in 12 years and my daughter's voice for the first time ever. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Questions.
That's right.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Sound-wise.
Yeah. If the sound is good in this room, I should be able to hear you. But it's a very banked auditorium, so it may be hard. We'll see.
Well, I'll try to speak slowly and loudly. It's obvious that if you had more electrodes, 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, that would be even better. But as long as the number is so limited, I wonder if it's clear that dividing in spectrally is the best thing, as opposed to using some speech recognition software to directly code phonemes.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's several issues here. The first is that it's actually not so obvious that more electrodes would be good. And the reason is that the electrodes are in a salty solution, which conducts electricity. And so one of the problems is that as you add electrodes, the currents spread. And so you start to stimulate places on the auditory nerve that you did not intend to stimulate. And so one of the reasons why the speech perception is so challenging compared to normal hearing is because of current spread. And so although many people believe there are devices now with 100 channels, devices at the University of Michigan, for example, which have been tested in rats, but rats don't care much about accents. So first of all, it may be true that if we can learn to target the electricity better, the current, that more electrodes will be better, then it's not so obvious that electrodes will be better unless we do that very well and very carefully. Now, the second thing is that, yes, the ability to extract important information, analyze that information in the application-specific integrated circuit, and then relay that to the cochlear is also something that's in its infancy. Much, much more work needs to be done. Much work is ongoing, for example, on better speech processing to help people appreciate music. Work at UC Irvine, for example, on that. But it's very, the music appreciation is a very subjective and very complicated thing. People that have never heard music before, prelingually deaf people, often enjoy music through a cochlear implant. Those that have heard music before have to learn tricks to enjoy music. For example, if I know what the music is ahead of time because it was the music I remembered from before I was deaf, we all possess wonderful musical memory. And so it's possible to actually hear something that sounds crude and awful like that music demonstration, but your brain will just fix it and make it right. And the top-down processing comes to the rescue. So I have to limit the kind of music I listen to, but then I can address it that way. I think eventually we will have ways of stimulating the auditory nerve with 10,000 individual electrodes. I don't think, though, that they'll be the kind of electrodes we have today with electric current passing between them. It's more likely that they will be fiber optics that carry infrared light. The infrared light can be targeted at tiny populations of surviving nerve cells. just the ones you want for that frequency. And so we will really recreate the hair cells, in a sense. This work is already ongoing and has been quite encouraging at a number of universities. However, there's not yet complete understanding about why the infrared light causes the neurons to fire. Many believe it's actually heating of water in the cells. And we don't know whether you can continually stimulate the auditory nerve this way for years and expect someone to not develop a chronic problem in the auditory nerve that will lead to its lack of function. So that's, does that sort of answer the general thread of your question, or was there more? Okay.
Yeah. Are you thinking of ever having two?
You bet.
And if you do, would the second implant have to be coordinated with the first one, or could you go for a better one and hear just as well?
That's a very good question. I mean, the devices are improving all the time, although there hasn't been much improvement since the device they got in 2002. If I implanted again tomorrow, then I would go with pretty much the same device because I'm very happy with it. I would have two and I'd be able to know where sounds come from, which would be great. I'd be able to understand better in noisy situations. These things are virtually guaranteed. If, however, it was possible to get a better implant, I would do that. Why do I only have one? The reason is because I live in the United States and it costs $60,000. But most people only have one. I mean, the benefits from one are already so great that many people argue that the extra gain from two is not significant enough. However, this is a value judgment made by hearing people about people that can't hear so well. If you ask the people that have one implant, would they like a second? Most of them would tell you that they would want one tomorrow if they could get it. Now, at the time I became deaf, I believed that we would learn a lot about neuron regeneration. And I was hopeful also that we'd learn a great deal about hair cell regeneration. I thought the two would go together and that by 2007 or so, we'd be able to regenerate hair cells, regenerate auditory nerves to perfection, and that I would get my hearing back naturally. But then in about 2002 or 2001, around the time I was looking at the implant, I talked to a number of people that work in those areas, and they all told me that that was years away. You know, another 20, 30, 40, 50 years away before we could do that. And so because those kind of solutions are not yet available, I agreed to sacrifice one ear, where I had residual hearing, 1% hearing. So this one, this ear, has no hearing now because I have a cochlear implant in it. So it has artificial electrical or bionic hearing only. This one still has 1% hearing. And so the question is whether I should sacrifice the 1% hearing. It's, you don't do much with 1%. So I'd be happy to sacrifice it if somebody wants to give me $60,000. No. And yeah, they wouldn't have to be correlated. They could be quite different. Yeah. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. There are too many areas very non-linear to loudness.
Yes.
Yes,
well, the way you do that is that you decide to use a compression. The question is about the fact that as sounds get louder, they don't produce in the basilar membrane proportionately larger displacements. It's not one-to-one. And this enables us to code those sounds very efficiently and pass them in the auditory nerve to the brain. And then somehow the brain expands those sounds again and we get the full range of sound. With a cochlear implant, we try to simulate that same thing by using a compression of the sound input. So we measure the sound volume, and then we put out a current that uses compression again. There are problems, though. It's not possible to use the full dynamic range of natural hearing because the difference between the tiniest current for which I will perceive a sound and the current for which I will have a very great pain in my ear is only about 50 decibels, whereas in natural hearing it's about 120 decibels. So that means I don't have the same sense of loudness that you have, which is why when I give this talk I ask hearing people in the room to tell me about volume, so that, because I can't tell whether that music was too loud except by the fact that you were cringing. Because it doesn't get louder for me after a certain point because we've made a decision here in the chip that after about 70 or 80 decibels we're just going to hold it constant. I'm not going to have any more sound. And lower down the range, we take the soft sounds from 10 decibels up to 50, and we try to put 60, and we try to put that in the first part of the range where I can take the currents from a few microamps up to about 20 microamps. After that, you feel a prick in your ear with the current. So when I first had the device, I was very encouraged by the fact that every time I would go back to the hospital, which was about once every 3 weeks, they could turn up the current more and I could hear more. And so I said, let's keep turning up the current. And so we did. We turned it up. And at a certain point, the pains became... That was very, very bad. And so I said, I can live with it. I can take it. I really want to hear more. And so for a day or two, I lived with this throbbing in my ear, and then we backed off because we were probably doing damage to the auditory nerve. But does that answer the question? So it's compression. Yeah, and we do that electronically. I can't hear that one square. I'm not sure. If he stands, that'll be harder. You know, the challenge is that as you get further back in the room, my microphone works this way. A cone of reception comes out like this. So if you're at the same height as me, I hear it really well. But the higher up you get, the more your voice will... Yeah, I've got to go closer to him so I can hear. Yeah. But you're hard to understand. I talked to him earlier. Yeah. Right. Mammals all have basilar membranes. Not all mammals have the same type of amplification that we do. And so their hearing is somewhat different to ours. The mechanics of the basilar membrane varies from mammal to mammal, enabling some mammals to hear frequencies that are much higher than us, for example. Dogs hear up to maybe 50 kilohertz. So some mammals have amplification with hair cells and some don't. The hair cell diagrams that I showed you and the explanations I gave you were also greatly simplified, and in addition, there is no complete agreement about the complete process that involved in the amplification. We don't fully understand how the hair cells provide us, for example, with an ability to hear a noise. You saw how cochlear implantees have a great deal of difficulty hearing in a noisy environment. But most mammals can pick out a signal in noise, and the reason we can do that is because our outer hair cells are controlled by our brains. We can actually say, here's a signal at 10 kilohertz. It's a very important signal. I've got to focus on that. So we'll up the amplification of those hair cells whilst turning off others to concentrate on a sound. The relevance to your question is that the whole development of our hearing physiology, which is so remarkable, occurred because of a need to survive in a world where dinosaurs and other people and creatures were trying to destroy us. And so we developed an incredibly acute hearing, which enabled us to dodge enemies while understanding that those people over there were friendly, who though they were wielding clubs. And a need to understand sound in a very complex way. Most mammals have that same need. And so they've developed a rather similar system. It's just that they will have maybe a different relevant frequency range over which it works. And that's just coming from the mechanics of the basilar membrane. And so the cochlea is very similar in most mammals. It's usually, but not always, the helix. Sometimes it's actually straight. The helix is a complicated business. Some people say that there's a helix only because it's efficient use of space. But in fact, that's not... Just last year, there was a nice article in Science, and we now know why there's a helix. As the fluids flow in the basilar membrane, they move towards the outer radius. And if the radius is tightly curled, the effect of moving outward is greater, and that tips the basilar membrane very efficiently, which aids the detection of low frequencies. Only discovered last year. We don't fully understand all of the dynamics of the ear, but it is very similar in most mammals. We know more about the guinea pig, perhaps, than the human, because that's the one that's studied the most. Did that sort of answer the question?